The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to another weekend bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. This has been a long time coming for two reasons. Number one, it's been about 6 months since Chris Messina's been on for one of these properly. We used to do them every other week for about a year and a half, but Chris is back finally. Hey, Chris.
Hey, howdy. Welcome to 2024.
Yeah. Let's get into what you've been talking about and arguing about eventually. But also, we have an excellent guest who shockingly has never been on the show. He needs no introduction, but John Gruber, welcome to the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast.
I don't know about the needing no introduction, but I'm very happy to be here.
There's not a single person listening to this that doesn't know who you are. Before we do anything else, I thought what we should do is bring up what Chris and I have been arguing about a little bit offline, and not arguing, but having a little disagreement about. But you know, CES was this week, and as you heard on the show, I highlighted the Rabbit R1, that little AR. Or not AI thingy that was sort of like a smartphone, but not. And then I did on the show on Thursday that all of a sudden they sold out in 24 hours. I'm going to let Chris go first because I said on Threads sort of facetiously that this was the best hardware launch of the last 5 years that I've seen. But Chris, give me your impressions of the Rabbit R1 and why you're a little skeptical of it. And then I want to hear John's take on any of these sort of smartphone replacements.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's funny because I was seeing the Rabbit ads on X, ironically enough, even though I'm not there anymore, days before the launch. And so I was excited to actually post it to Product Hunt, you know, as one does. And I believe that you sent me a link to the keynote once it was out and you were like, you must watch this. And so instantly, I dropped everything and realized that now I had like 25 minutes that I had to blow on this long keynote. And so I got to admit that I sort of scrubbed through it. And the beginning I thought was like pretty strong. I was like, okay, this is like an interesting entrant. You know, I watched the Humane AI Pin launch, had a certain thought for like, you know.
Which I would argue was a worse sort of intro video, but we can come to that.
Well, it was at least a little bit shorter. However, look, there's so many different ways to unpack this. What I would say is that there is seemingly an opening in the marketplace to define what an AI type interface is going to look like that goes beyond sort of a black sheet of glass. And mostly it's voice, but also it needs to have eyeballs so it can see things and, you know, read the refrigerator and tell you what to make. You know, it's got some way to like talk to you or whatever. So it's getting those capabilities. So I loved the visual industrial design of the Rabbit. Teenage Engineering did a great job on that, as they do with most of their products. These guys are kind of a generational talent when it comes to that. But once I saw the founder, unfortunately, I don't know his name.
Jesse Liu.
Okay.
L-Y-U. Liu. Okay.
I don't know where he came from. He sort of new on the scene, just sort of blew out of nowhere. And he started to go down the kind of demos. Unfortunately, I am probably like a terrible critic because now that I'm an investor in the AI space, I see a lot of stuff super early. And basically what he was showing was like the greatest hits of the last 6 months of stuff from the agentive AI space, where there's things like LangChain and LangSmith and other types of essentially kind of piping one type of LLM into the next, with the ability to then take actions through internet APIs. And it isn't that I disagree with the orientation to the opportunity problem space. It's just that this is exactly what we were describing 6 years ago when we were working on bots and conversational AI. So does it need a physical form factor? Does it need to have its own LAM, this large action model? And furthermore, if it's not replacing the phone, which you said it's not, whereas the AI pin is supposed to, like, how do you relate to this as a product? And so maybe I just don't understand, like, a multi-device person in the future. You know, you've got the watch, you've got the phone, you've got your rabbit, you've got a pin, you've got AirPods, you've got, you know, goggles. Like, we're basically going to be strapped to the max, you know, with all these things that don't talk to each other.
I said that on the show.
I don't get it.
And John, go ahead and go in a second. But like I said, well, this is reintroducing a second device into your pocket, because it's not like you're going to get rid of your smartphone. But what did you think of the Rabbit R1?
It's very funny. So as soon as I saw it, I wasn't really paying attention to day one of CES or whenever it was announced, but it was like somehow one of the Slacks I'm on, a group chat, somebody posted, I saw it. And my first thought was, whoa, that thing is a ripoff of Panic's Playdate, the little yellow game player. And within like 10 seconds found out that, oh, Rabbit had gone partnered with Teenage Engineering to do the industrial design. Well, that's who did the industrial design of Panic's Playdate. So of course they look like siblings. And I thought, oh, well, if this company is smart enough to partner with Teenage Engineering, and I'm as effusive about their talents as Chris is, I was like, I $199? Screw it, I'm just buying it. And I literally pre-ordered before I watched the keynote. Because it's like, $200 is like just under my threshold, or not just under.
It's a beautiful device. So even if you just like have it lying around.
Right.
And also we can get into that. Like, that's also something that Humane maybe needs to think about. But you know what, John, what I've seen a lot of people say is like when they see the article or whatever, and then people send them the keynote, as opposed to Chris, a lot of people are like, oh, once I see the keynote, I'm convinced. Like, what did you think of the keynote?
I love the keynote. I did too. I liked that the CEO, Jesse Liu, I know I can't enunciate Chinese very well, but I'm glad he did it. And yes, he's not super polished. He's not a pitchman, but there's a certain genuine.
There was an authenticity.
Authenticity. Yes, that's what made it better.
And he did not overhype it. No. Like, Humane had like 2 years of saying, this is going to change everything.
And it's hard not to compare them directly against them, Rabbit against Humane, because they're obviously directly competing devices. And Humane, every single way that you can contrast them, there's a difference. Humane had this years-long hype cycle beforehand. The Apple pedigree that they've emphasized in that hype cycle.
They've raised boatloads of money
to the point where I know from my sources that the leaning on the Apple pedigree is these are not popular people inside Apple Park, and there's a lot of it's not just that people who leave Apple are expected not to talk about having been at Apple, but that the credit for Apple devices is Apple. And to the degree that they don't even put engineers' names in the about boxes of the software anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing. It's not like that they've spilled secrets about Apple that they came out, but that the taking of credit for doing stuff is so contrary to the Apple culture that that more than anything, it's not like, oh, Apple is worried about this company or something like that. It's just, it's personal. But anyway, they had this hype cycle. They have a $700 price point. And again, I don't know what my threshold is for an impulse buy, but these two devices prove that number is between 200 and 700.
Yes,
it is. Because I have not pre-ordered a Humane AI pin.
Right.
And it's, you know, and I did this without looking at the keynote. And then I did watch the keynote, and I had like this sort of sine wave up and down where I'm like, oh yeah, I'm glad I pre-ordered. And then like at the 3 minute mark, I'm like,
he needed editing, but at the same time, they also at Humane needed editing. So they didn't seem like a weird cultish sort of, you know, guru sort of thing. Yeah.
But ultimately I got through the end of the keynote and I'm glad I pre-ordered. And then it so happens that I think within the last 24 hours of us talking, they've announced that they've cut off pre-sales and said that this is a sellout. They're not shipping. It's a very unusual to me way of putting a ship date. They're shipping at quote Easter. And I don't even know. No. I grew up Catholic. I don't practice anymore. But it's the most unusual holiday in the Western world because it changes every year. I don't know what that means. I mean, I get it, you know, but they did also.
They probably don't have a huge team to figure out the messaging of what they're going to do. But, go ahead.
But the other thing, the other big, I mean, we could keep going about the fundamental differences between the way that, even though they're same sort of device, but the big one that Rabbit did that Humane didn't is Humane went all in on no screen. We're not going to have a screen. We're not going to have a screen. And I can't help
except
but think.
Except for the one on your hand.
Right. Which I can't help but think that they got so caught up at some point in the development cycle on we don't want to have a screen on our thing that we're making. And then they got to these edge cases where it's like, but we have to show something. We have to show text in some way. And then they came up with this project a laser thing onto your hand and then have the camera see when you tap virtual buttons or whatever. And it's like, no, what Rabbit did is the more obvious answer. Just put a goddamn screen on the thing.
Well, okay. This will lead us into discussing what Apple could be doing with AI going forward, which is the thing that was the most interesting to me was the sort of obviating the need for interacting with apps in the sense that yes, you have a screen, but it's not a screen where you're doing Uber and tapping that and doing this and tapping that. It's literally talking to it. Now we can, and you know, Chris is a product guru. You're a Mac and Apple sort of, design. Yeah, aficionado. So you guys can tell me how this could evolve. But the thing to me that kind of blew me away more than the device, which was sexy as hell, don't get me wrong, was the idea that yes, that's it. That's it. That the agent goes between the apps and does the thing for you. So whoever wants to take this, we're assuming that WWDC this year will be about a lot of AI integration into iOS and whatever OS. What do either of you think about what that means for... I'm not tapping an app and going into an app and doing a thing. I'm just picking up my phone and doing a thing, which is what sort of Rabbit is suggesting. Chris is squinting his eyes, is suggesting the future might be. Whoever wants to go, go.
I'll just jump on that. Just because, like I said, I'm leaning a bit on my sort of legacy experience here, where the dream of conversational software was alive and well. Basically in 2016, 2017, I worked at Uber where we had an API and you could book a ride via voice and that was all there. I think the real thing that we learned, to John's point about needing a screen, is that unless you live in a world where there are infinite dollars and infinite undos and customer service is abundant and amazing, and essentially for any time a robot screws up, you get your money back and there's no problem, people need to be able to confirm things along the way to make sure that the right thing happens, right? So there was a whole demo that the CEO gave about booking a trip to some random place with a bunch of highly nebulous like things. I mean, if I gave that to, you know, my partner Joe and she went off to like book the thing, I'd probably have some critique of like her choices. Not that I don't think she has great choices or taste, but just because I want to make sure that this actually makes sense. So to get to a point where you can ask a computer to do these things for you without human nuance or without a sense for kind of like the vibe that you want, even if you can kind of modify the request or the prompt to be like actually make it a little bit more like loosey-goosey, the thought that you don't want to have agency in that process made it highly dubious that this product is going to work the way that humans actually prefer to work. And so, you know, the $200 price point is amazing. 10,000 people are going to get this thing. They're going to ask it to book a trip. It's going to have what, your credit card on file. It's going to execute all these things. Suddenly people are going to have tens of thousands of dollars of credit card, you know, transactions on their account that they didn't anticipate because they didn't expect it to buy the $5,000 flight because it's available. And now you've got to undo all that shit. And so hopefully there's a robot that will do that for you and will, you know, like talk down the prices. So that agentic web is something that's been available. It's just that the risk of moving in that direction as quickly as this thing suggests, I think we're just not ready.
I will just say that I've had an Alexa in the kitchen for I don't know how many years.
Yeah, how many flights has it booked for you?
I don't even buy stuff from Amazon on it, and that's from their own store, so they're not
The whole use case was like buy me toilet paper, and you're right. It's going to buy the wrong stuff.
And I don't know. It was just a couple of weeks ago, and Alexa chirped up in the kitchen about something. I forget what color. It's like an orange light instead of blue, and I was what is that?
Colors.
And Alexa wanted to tell me that one of our recurring purchases, I don't know, it's like my wife has like trash bags.
Subscribe and save or something.
Yeah, subscribe and save. And we get trash bags or paper towels or something like that on a regular basis. And Alexa was like, if you'd like to order more, just say. And I'm like, no, I do not want to order anymore.
Stop.
That's just from Alexa. I don't trust it for that. And so I think
years of experience. I mean, it's a huge platform.
But that demo was to me over the line. But this is
Chris's point. Chris's point is that the demo looked amazing, but he doesn't believe that the actual product will deliver what the demo
is. So let me step back, right? I want to make my point clear, because I don't want to just shit all over some tech demo that's cool and interesting. I think there's a level of thought that needs to go into this next era of AI tech that is about service design and is about thinking about the moments where human agency needs to be brought into the mix, where computers can do a whole lot of work, come up with five different flight plans and present it to me as a pitch.com deck, show me sell me on it as a travel agent might, but without any pressure. And let me think about it. Like that would be an amazing use of this kind of conversational AI such that I can make a better decision, more informed decision, and I have to do less work. And then I look like a hero to my family, friends, office, whatever. But instead of delegating all access and authority and agency to the agents, that to me is a recipe for disaster. And that's where I feel like both the AI pin and this rabbit device haven't quite gone deep enough into how people really want to be able to relate to these things in a way that feels like they have some control and confidence.
I do think though, and again, the proof will be in the pudding when it ships, but it seems like if there's, I don't know about a breakthrough, I don't know if it's unique, but it does seem like what they're talking about, what they're calling the LAM, the action.
The large action model. Yeah.
Right.
So that's,
Right. Which is so the language models are the ones that whether you're typing or whether it's voice, it's human using words and the AI giving words back. It doesn't really matter whether it's text or text to speech. It's the language. The action model is what they're claiming is that their AI is able to parse website user interfaces, right? And so you don't have to go through an API
right
to do these things. I keep using the verb drive. And the way I think about this is, and I think this is undeniable, is where we're going eventually is to have C-3POs or R2-D2s in our house. Actual robots that are with us and that are you can talk to in a reasonable way and that can do things for you. Whether it would actually be, an actual humanoid or some other shape, but an actual robot that can go up and down your stairs, move around your house. And if you could say to C-3PO, cook, how about you make us a chicken dish for dinner, or look in the fridge and tell me what can you make us for dinner.
Right.
And C-3PO could, what would C-3PO do? It wouldn't, the robot that can cook you dinner isn't going to pop the dinner out of its belly, like a gag on the Jetsons or something like that. It's going to actually, it's going to go
in next year.
It's going to go into your kitchen and look in your fridge and use your stove and your oven.
Well, however, by that point, it probably is ordering the things on your behalf and making but I hear what you're saying.
But you know what I mean? It's not going to be a robot that is a refrigerator and a microwave and a thing. It's going to use this. And baby steps along the way, it seems like Rabbit's vision of this is sort of doing that with websites, right? So, and it's just software, but it's driving the Uber website or the DoorDash website or whatever, the way that a physical robot in the not too distant future, I'm convinced, will use the things in your house, and go actually open the door for you to take a package from FedEx.
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity, but user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. With everybody fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. With Constant Contact, you'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track growth. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence knowing your emails are actually reaching your customers thanks to Constant Contact's best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. I use this, and you should too. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee, so get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com. The not too distant future, next Sunday AD, real heads will know that reference. But let me bring this to the iPhone and the iOS and things like that. So again, what you're describing is that the robot in your house just does the things, it interacts with the things. On an OS level on a smartphone, the thing that struck me about this was the vision that what if eventually the way OSs go is that you're just interacting with a better Siri. And so when you're booking a car, you're booking the groceries, you're not going into the app. So like right now, I go into my smartphone and my experience, it's like, you know how the car companies are all obsessed with like, we don't want CarPlay, we don't want Google's, whatever it's called, because we want to own the experience in the car, right? So, but in your phone right now, you still have the experience with Seamless, with Spotify or whatever, but is the future of the OS is what made, this is what I was thinking about, whether or not Rabbit works. Does it obviate apps? Does it obviate icons where it's just you're interacting with the bot? In which case, that makes sense to me, and it probably makes sense to Apple and everybody else, but what does that do to everybody that's not Apple or Google or whoever makes the hardware?
So, look, again, the thesis that we're going to a post-app world is compelling. And I'm just going to repeat myself. It is what we were working on in the early bot era, because the thought was, and I literally had this in like a keynote that I gave. It's like, once you've got 2 million apps in the app store, there becomes a question as to how a person is expected to navigate that space where you have a Squircle chiclet that represents some functionality that has some obtuse name that you remember somehow. And then you launch that app, that little chiclet, by tapping on it, and by creating an account, and then by doing the things that it wants you to do, by going through a series of onboarding steps until finally you get into some loop or flow where you come back and use that app on a regular basis. And the reality is that years ago, most people download apps and then they never even launch them for the very first time. So there is definitely like a gap and a challenge with the existing app ecosystem. I think what Rabbit did was perhaps one of the first examples where they're like talking about, here's what a post app world will do. And the way in which we get to post app is not actually post app. We will just have a computer that knows how to read a screen like a human does, and it'll push the buttons that a human would push. Because frankly, it's the easiest way to get to the API on the other side, rather than writing a bunch of bespoke code that integrates with everyone's bespoke API. So the whole thing that really happened with apps is that we moved from a world before where you had maybe backend systems that would integrate together through enterprise software deals, to one where you needed an API. You as a business needed to open up an API to connect to an app that was in the app store that would then connect to your customers. And that was the appification of the broad sort of commercial space. Now that those APIs exist, and now that most companies have opened up APIs to the outside world, now we will have AI that actually works to sew together a number of integrations between these things in an opportunistic sort of way. In other words, Brian, to your point, the challenge is that, you know, maybe you use, you know, Taboola or HelloFresh, and you know, I use Blue Apron or Sunbasket, and we have a robot that lives at home and it needs to be able to order food on our behalf. Each of those platforms have a different way of taking in our preferences or our food allergies or, you know, the frequency in which we want meals delivered. And so they need to be able to go to each one of those different websites or each of those different apps and make sense of them, because frankly, it's a bunch of different choices just based on a brand. And so I do think that we'll be outsourcing to AIs to do that. And we thought that we were going to do that with voice assistants like Alexa and the Google Assistant. And instead, we didn't have LLMs. LLM is the game changer that then allows us to have late bindings, which in other words, is another way to say a computer can come up to an interface that it's never seen before. And because it has billions of examples, apply the, what are those things called where you put the coin in the top and then it sort of goes, you know,
Plinko.
Palinko, whatever that thing is. Exactly. Yeah. More or less kind of what an LLM is doing to get to the right action on the other end, and then it executes for you. So we've been here before, and it's just now about to start happening. But apps will stick around for some period of time, just like newspapers have, as a means to get to the thing that we want to actually achieve on the other end. And so Rabbit is the first, I think, to say it out loud in a way that allows us to, for people to get excited about it. But it's because we have enabling technology that just arrived last year that suddenly now. And so the last point I'll make on this, and John, like I think you'll have some insights into this. Apple has one of the best accessibility frameworks for building applications out there. Mm-hmm. And that, what I mean by that is that whether you're, you know, you need voice assistance or you need touch assistance or, you know, you have low vision, all of those things that exist in the Mac and iOS ecosystem allow computers to see the software as well as humans that lack those certain capabilities. Those are the ways in which a system like a LAM will be able to interact better than anywhere else.
Couple of good, great points there. I'm largely aligned. And I think part of what Chris was getting at there is that technology, we tend to think of revolutions as blowing away what came before it, but that's not really what happens. Technology evolves in a sedimentary way, and the old layers stay there, right? Like, and nothing exemplifies that better than the way that macOS still comes with a terminal app and a complete command line, that is more or less instantly familiar to a time traveling Unix user from 1974.
Can't get rid of the command line, yeah.
Right, like somebody from Bell Labs in 1974 would be blown away by everything else in macOS, but if you sat them down in front of the terminal app, they'd be able to find their way around. It's still there. And I think apps are like that. And building AI to drive the app, like and the accessibility thing, I actually just brought that up on my other podcast, Dithering, with Ben Thompson tonight, talking about the Rabbit R1. It has to be. It is a real, real advantage that's overlooked by casual users who don't need the accessibility features because they're not hard of hearing or they don't have vision problems or something like that. But they really do benefit everybody, even if you don't have the
Well, and especially machines.
Right. And machine, what are machines except, you know, handicapped users, right? They have a handicap, which is that they're not human beings trying to use these things that are designed for human beings. But like, and you know, to go back to my kitchen analogy and cooking, like a human being who knows how to cook can go into a kitchen for the first time and they never saw this brand of stovetop before. They'll figure it out, right? Like, I've never used an induction oven, but you'll figure it out. You see, there's a dial, there's temperature. You know, AI excels at figuring things like that once it has the base idea of you've trained it on 500 existing ovens, now put it in front of a new one, it's going to figure it out. The difference, though, and this is where the pressure is all on Apple, is with the privacy model of iOS, where your app can't poke around another company's app. It's all on Apple's shoulders. So if Apple can do this and can, and you know, whether they keep the Siri brand name, which I think they'll probably do because it's so well established, but a future Siri that's truly a 2.0, you know, a brand new underpinning based on LLM and modern technology, could drive your iPhone by using the accessibility APIs, and your apps are still there. And it's the Uber app where you've used the app and tapped the little squircle and signed into your account and it has your credit card, and you could still use the Uber app the way you've always done it by using the app. But now the system can drive the app through these verbal commands and it would be using the same thing. And if you've ever seen like a completely blind user use an iPhone, it's astonishing. It's absolutely,
yeah, it can be so fast,
and it brings tears to your eyes to see that these people who you know, otherwise, you know, literally can't see anything, can navigate the iPhone and in ways that they, you know, because their other senses like touch are involved in a way that they couldn't even do. It's one of the things that iOS devices can do better than classic Mac or Windows computers, because the touch gives them this extra sense that they're more attuned to. So something like that, you know, except with Rabbit, they don't have that ability. So a Rabbit app on an iPhone or Android can't poke around the Uber app or the DoorDash app because of the privacy restrictions. And it, you know, that makes sense, but that's not the way things were a generation ago with the PC. Like with the PC, a breakthrough company like this could make a software product that poked around the system and poked at the buttons in these other apps. It wasn't
sandboxing like there is now.
Right. So without the sandboxing, like, so they could do it on the Mac, but the Mac doesn't make any sense because nobody's going to carry around.
So the other thing that I would add to that, though, is like shortcut seems to be becoming more and more important. Now, I don't know if that's sort of like a hobbyist area of Mac OS, but in terms of automation and the ability to string together, you know, what looks like kind of, you know, LangSmith, LangChain style agentive models where you have a set of commands.
That would be the way that maybe a third party could somehow do this. But you'd never get the permission to always be listening. You'd never get the access to the hardware to be able to take control of the camera. So I'm super happy that they built their own hardware so that they can write software that can make its own rules for when it's listening and when it's using the camera. They have to.
Okay. So let me ask something real quick though, because my question then is about where this kind of goes. And Brian, this will create an opening for you for your next topic.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
But what I want to sort of, I guess, parse out a little bit is to think about the future of these two companies and whether or not they've boxed themselves into a corner or whether or not they've actually created an opportunity for successive generations of products. So when the Humane Pin came out, it was like, this can't be the only thing. Like, this is just the opening salvo, and this is the first product that they're launching, and there'll be a suite of things that are part of the overall Humane, you know, kind of stack. Rabbit feels a little bit more like all chips are on this one device to make it. And, you know, at the same time, you've got Meta, you know, with Quest 3 and those types of devices trying to, again, create their own operating system and their own set of, you know, vernacular gestures that they can own. So I guess my question before we move on to the Vision Pro is this question of those two new entrants do we see that Humane is going to have several successive hardware products, or is the pin it? And, you know, where is Rabbit in a year? You know, how much runway do they really have to establish a beachhead as, you know, a player in the space versus, I mean, like the Playdate is great, but it's sort of like got a, you know, sort of niche community of people that love it. And it's not going to become like the next sort of, you know, Apple, you know, successor.
Well, it's funny to compare it to the Playdate because the Playdate is not Panic's main product. You know, Panic still runs the company by selling professional Mac software, you know, Coda and stuff like that.
I mean, maybe Rabbit sells, you know, Lamb, you know, and they provide access to that.
Right. But Panic can afford to have Playdate as a hobby, whereas Rabbit is a startup where this is their
only thing. It's existential.
I assume they have a, you know, if they, you know, and selling out, if they decided, if they knew in advance they were only going to try to sell 10,000 and doing it in 72 hours or 48 hours is a good sign that there's
enthusiasm. So part of my question too is also about the price point, right? Like the Rabbit is $200. That is, like you said, that is an impulse purchase.
Right.
I am so concerned that they built in no margin to cover customer service or support.
Well,
like not to mention like with, so you got $600 for the AI pin, plus it's another $40 or $50, whatever it is a month to get mobile service, right? So you've got, it's not just buying a Playdate and then playing it at home. It's like you're buying a relationship with a company where you want that product to be evolving constantly and it needs a cloud connection.
Well, I don't understand the thing that worries me the most about Rabbit. And again, if I, you know, a year from now, my Rabbit R1 no longer works. I mean, so what? I'm out. I bought this knowing that it might be disposable.
You put it on the shelf. It'll be great.
But I don't understand how a $200 one-time purchase can cover their ongoing cloud expenses.
Just running their LLM.
Right. Because one thing we know is that these LLMs, the cloud-based component of them, is extremely expensive. I mean,
Sam Altman is not an investor in Rabbit, as far as I know.
Yeah, right. Right.
But by, you know, it, so I don't know. I mean, I guess they've raised money and they have runway to go through, but presumably, I don't know that they're selling the hardware at a loss, but the service is, because the service has to have an ongoing cost. I mean, there's no other way around it.
The argument I made was this was the best launch of a hardware product I've seen in years. But Chris pointed out that as opposed to Humane, they came out of nowhere, which is sort of like that's maybe the better way to do it.
Oh, I think it is. I think it's also the more Apple way to do it. I think part of what was really weird about the Humane hype cycle is that's the opposite of the way Apple does things. Apple does not mention things. I mean, and we all knew this Vision Pro headset was coming, but Apple never said a goddamn word about it until WWDC last year when they were ready to announce it.
All right, let's go to the Vision Pro, which is, you know,
what's the release date? The February 2nd, right?
February.
Like,
yeah.
Pre-orders start Friday, the 19th of January, and shipping February 2nd.
Now, I want to put on the record that I am more excited about this than any Apple product going back beyond the Apple Watch. And you're on the record for your experiences are incredible. I don't want to do that. But what you were just talking about, we were just talking about like sort of like expectations and things like that. So there's not an event again to do the launch. I am very excited for this product, but one of the things that I thought about this when they announced it 6 months ago or whatever it was, or debuted it, was that, okay, then they will come out with something that will be a great, amazing app that they can launch with. And, or like they mentioned, other people have said, you know, Disney was on stage with them, you know. So the fact that there is no event, that it's just going to come here and stand in line and you can demo it, I'm just curious what your thoughts are in terms of how Apple is thinking about launching this as a product. It's clear that they don't think they're going to blow the roof off. No one thinks that because it's a hugely expensive product. But what do you think about like the slower roll than even people like I thought they would slow roll?
I'm surprised that I'm not booking a flight for a Cupertino event, you know, in between now and February 2nd. I just assumed it. And it is unusual because Apple does not have new product lines very often. And I just thought, well, they tend to be a company of patterns, I often say. And I thought, well, look at what they did with Apple Watch. They announced the Apple Watch in September of 2014 at the iPhone event. And they had a whole big one more thing segment, and they showed it and they said it's, you know, and we've got the sport model and the steel model and the gold model, and said it starts at $399, and everybody was left guessing what the stupid gold ones would cost. And then in, I don't know what month, but it was like March of 2015, they had a whole separate event to reintroduce it and say, and now this was the onstage era, but it was another onstage keynote, and they had new things. It wasn't that they redefined it since September, but they reiterated it and they had new demos. I thought we would see something like that, you know, like maybe just a half, you know, now that they do these pre-recorded sort of shows that are not really, you know, the keynotes are all pre-recorded. I thought maybe like a half hour one just about this.
Or even that would be the opportunity to be like, hey, here's how, pick your partner. Look at this amazing app that in the last 6 months they put together.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I thought we'd see more, like something like that. And that was part of the reason for pre-announcing it. And instead, even the first party demos that they're showing, example videos and this stuff, it's all the same stuff they showed in June. There's like somebody's, you know, of course somebody did it, but somebody,
there was one new clip of video. Yeah.
Yeah. There was like one new clip of video. But otherwise no other features, no third party apps that they had like a list of some of the first third party apps that they know that are already coming out. Fantastical and Jira. And I forget who else is on the list. I think that it's why is it sort of low key? I mean, that's how I would describe it, is very low key. And I don't think that it's the price per se. I know $3,500 is a lot for a consumer electronics device, but inflation adjusted, the original 1984 Mac was not inflation adjusted. It started at like $2,500, and inflation adjusted, that's like $6,000 or $7,000. So like, a 1984 Mac in today's dollars was like $7,000. I mean, this is $3,500 is not unprecedented. And there's a lot more people who follow Apple and are interested in computers. Like 1984 was a time when there were an awful lot of people who even were gadget hounds and bought lots of expensive hi-fi stereo equipment and TVs and projectors and stuff like that.
What I'm suggesting is that even Apple knows that there will be people that will line up to do a demo, but they're not going to be able to report to Wall Street that we've sold 100,000 units.
Well, I think the problem is going... I think the problem is supply constraints. And I haven't heard anything to dispute it. I don't go too far into the rumors, but the supply chain rumors tend to be the most accurate because some of the companies that Apple works with, they blab. And Apple's relying on these... They're more than 4K each, but two of these displays, one for each eye, made by Sony, and nobody else can make them. And by all reports, there's like a hard cap at Sony's production of like... It's like 2 million a year at this point. So theoretically, the most of these things Apple could sell is 1 million, and it might be lower than that. And that's if... It doesn't matter what the price is. They can't sell more than 1 million of them.
But Apple...
And that's nothing for Apple.
And so, Sony releases PlayStations that they can't sell because they have supply chain constraints. What I'm saying is, does Apple know strategically that this is... We have to lowball this and low sort of sotto voce this because no one's going to pay $35. No,
they will. No, I'm telling you what's going... I think what's going to happen is this is going to come out on the pre-order start on January 19th. And people who are late to the pre-order on January 19th are already going to start getting shipping dates into March and April. And I think... For the better half of 2024, I don't know if they'll be able to catch up by the holiday season, but I think for months and through the first half of the year, I think this thing is going to be backordered 12 weeks or maybe even more. Nobody's going to be able to get their hands on one. And I think Apple knows that. There's no way they can make more of them. They're not going to be able to meet demand. And so why get hundreds of millions or their billion user fan base, the sort of numbers who buy new AirPods or who buy new iPhones, why get them all excited to buy this thing that they're not even going to be able to get their hands on?
It seems so. So there's.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines, their family group chat, their crossword puzzles, just because they're available right now or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. And you can search by location, availability, and insurance. So literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated patient-reviewed credible doctors and specialists. I have personally used ZocDoc to find a podiatrist when I needed one for the first time ever in my life. Go to ZocDoc.com/techmeme and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/techmeme. ZocDoc.com/techmeme. Let's be real for a minute. Most guys would wear a t-shirt every day of their lives if they could. The problem is that most t-shirts are not acceptable to wear at work or out on a hot date night. But today's sponsor, Cuts, has finally changed that. Cuts t-shirts are such high quality, wrinkle-free, and so buttery soft that you can look like you're dressing up even when you're dressing down. Yeah, you heard that. Wrinkle-free. You never have to substitute comfort for fashion ever again. If you see me in a t-shirt, it's likely one from Cuts. I'm also a huge fan of their AO five-pocket pants, the right sort of step up from jeans without going all the way into dress pants, like literally my ideal Venn diagram of professional looking but comfortable feeling. When you touch something from Cuts, you can immediately feel the quality. Their proprietary fabric blends are ridiculously soft and breathable, they don't wrinkle, and they look way more expensive than they actually are. For a limited time, our listeners get 20% off your entire order when you use code RIDE at checkout. That's 20% off your order at cutsclothing.com with promo code RIDE. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the perfect blend of style and comfort with Cuts Clothing. cutsclothing.com, promo code RIDE for 20% off.
I could sort of, you know, completely buy that aspect of it in terms of access. The other thing that I would point out or ask is whether or not this type of product and device requires a new type of messaging and marketing. And eventually, or essentially, it needs to be kind of invented. And because the, I don't want to say the response is kind of like lukewarm, but there's not sufficient pull that says, this is the use case. This is the thing you want it for. Essentially, they have a number of kind of use cases that they've developed into, you know, classy, attractive, you know, videos that are on rails with happy paths. They've seen what Meta did, and those things are just kind of a video game device. They don't want to be that. And so essentially, in order to lower the risk, I mean, yes, supply chain stuff all withstanding, there is almost a need to be like, come to the store, see it for yourself, mm-hmm. because we can't show you what spatial computing is. You have to experience it. And that's a different level of commitment than just seeing AirPods, you know, that are like $300. And it's like, you know, noise cancellation and, you know, Siri and whatever else it is. And so that feels like one of the reasons why perhaps the approach is being taken that's a lot slower, a lot more careful. It seems like, you know, you've got HoloLens in the previous era. You've got whatever Sony's doing that's at CSS this year, I think.
I mean, the Meta stuff is pretty evolved at this point. But
I know, but like it feels yeah. like...
But it's not evolved in the way that Apple's envisioning
yes,
this. Apple's aspirations in this are so they're truly profound. I mean, that's why they're calling it spatial computing. It's not because they wanted to invent a new term and everybody else is calling it AR and VR and they want to invent their own term and they're calling it spatial computing. They see this as like the, you know, as big a deal as desktop computing. And then mobile computing as defined by the iPhone and the modern era of that this is like the third flag in the ground. There was, or maybe there was four. There was like the Apple II era where you could just have a computer at all in your home and it was all caps, you know, it didn't even have lowercase mm-hmm. letters. And then 7 years later came the Macintosh and the computer for the rest of us. and truly establishing the paradigm for personal computing for decades to come. Still today, I'm using a computer today that would be very familiar to a 1984 Macintosh user. That's what they're thinking. And I do think, I think Chris is right. In the same way that Apple came out with the Mac in 1984, but when did most people buy a computer that had a mouse, whether it was an Apple computer or a Windows computer, but a computer that worked like that with Windows on screen and a mouse that you moved around and you double click on apps and you cut, copy and paste and stuff like that. It was the 90s before people bought it, right? For, and the iPhone was similar. The iPhone was like a curiosity until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years in, and then all of a sudden, it seemed like everybody had one.
I never imagined that I would tell my mother to buy an iPhone until she told me she bought an iPhone. I get all that. Let me ask you this. I've said this on the show, and Chris and I, unfortunately, are investors these days, so we're thinking about go-to-market. Why is the go-to-market not the iPhone replacement, but the Mac replacement? Because that, to me, is more compelling.
Is it? I don't know that that's true.
Wait, more compelling to me?
No. You're saying, sorry. What I was hearing you say is that Apple is taking an approach where this is a Mac replacement.
Well, okay, right. No, Apple's not saying
as opposed to this is a new category.
Yes. But what I'm saying is the go-to-market. Okay, so forget what I said, iPhone replacement, because you're right. That's what all the press is saying. Okay.
And the reason why this is important relative to our previous conversation is the AI pin is being pitched as a replacement for the phone.
Yeah.
The Rabbit is not being replaced as a replacement. It's being pitched as a watch adjacent product where you just carry lots of things around and you've got your, you know, bag of goodies and, you know, you pick out whichever one talks to you in the best way. The spatial computing as a concept is a destination.
Okay. Let me complete my thought, because I'm curious to hear John's thought on this. To me, to sell me on a $3,500 face mask is it would replace my Mac, because I have a screen here. I have a screen there. I have this whole setup here. And if I could do this and anywhere I went, I could have all of this. That actually makes sense to me. Why are they're saying spatial computing, but why are they not selling this as a replacement for a laptop or a Mac or whatever?
Because I think they think it might be, but I think it's years ahead. And I think that one thing Apple's institutionally learned is they're a very patient company now. I think it's overlooked. I
mean, they can afford to be more than ever.
Right. But they look at things like Apple Pay. And remember, Apple Pay first came out and then it was like, I don't know, 4 months later, somebody went around and was like, oh my God, there's only like 7% of stores in San Francisco support Apple Pay. This thing's a bust, you know, blah, blah, blah. Apple just, they knew it was going to take a while. It required the retailers to swap out their hardware and stuff. And they knew it was going to take years. And now you go everywhere and I'm shocked when Apple Pay isn't available somewhere. Right. And that just happens. It didn't happen overnight. But we want things to happen overnight, right? We want that moment like January 2007 when Steve Jobs held up the first iPhone and things did change overnight. It's like, holy shit, that is from the future. That almost never happens. And the idea that something in the vision, you know, and the fact that they're calling this first one, I keep saying Vision Pro, is that it's as close as Apple could possibly come out and say is, we promise we're going to come out with Vision non-pros that have lower prices eventually.
The Vision S.
Yeah, or the Vision Air or something like that.
Sure. The Vision Air, that's pretty good.
But it would be, and if it's lighter too, that would be a big help. It would actually, you know, again, like in the same way that a MacBook Air is often a better computer for a lot of people than a MacBook Pro because it's lighter and you don't need the Pro. It's like, I don't know, I think Vision Air might be a much better product, not just price, it'll be years ahead, and maybe it is, but I think this might be the first product Apple makes that could replace the Mac for more people than the iPod or iPad did, because it is bigger, right? And it's like even the biggest iPad, the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, is a tiny screen compared to what a lot of professional Mac users are like, whereas this device, you can have a giant cinema screen, you know, literally like a movie theater screen in front of you.
Let me build on this point, because I think there's something important and critical in what you're saying. And I don't even think we're thinking that far forward enough, right? Like, what you said is that this could replace the Macs for people. I think this is more interesting from a generational shift, that the very first Macs some people might get in 10 years from now might be a descendant of the Vision product. And this loops back to everything that we were talking about, whether it's in terms of conversational software or like the content that I'm seeing developed currently, whether it's AI, generative AI video content or imagery or spatial images or spatial audio. These things that are so rich and so dense in their fidelity to, I mean, almost beyond reality, requires platforms through which people can actually consume and interact with those things. So my point in question is actually, are there enough developers, one, who have the ability or the knowledge to develop for VisionOS in a way where the apps are compelling? I would posit that the answer is just like the iPhone in 2007, when most people were building web apps and you couldn't build native apps. And it took a long time to move away from the sort of design paradigm of desktop apps into mobile. Well, in a similar way, developers have to go through the entire onboarding and education process and re-education of learning how to build spatial apps. And I got to say, like, Apple's been putting out a lot of content to that end, and it's impressive to see. But I got to imagine that most developers are still trying to figure out how to, you know, integrate OpenAI and LLMs and are not worried about spatial computing because the audience is not there. And that's why it's got to be a 10-year prospect where kids are coming out of school knowing how to design for spatial computing and not knowing how to design for the web. And that's going to be the inflection point where someone says, my first computer is going to be a Vision XX, whatever. And that is the computing thing that happens. And so that's, you know, I think to build on John's point, why it's going to take some time.
Yeah. And you know, and I think Apple had that patience, for example, with the iPhone. You know, they knew that a US, a one carrier in one country was not going to set the world afire. Oh,
and multi-touch was a huge right. change.
Right. But they, you know, it give us a couple years and we'll, you know, this thing will spread to more carriers, more countries around the world. But there was no possible way that the original iPhone, I think it was about as successful as it could have possibly been. And Jobs' goal was in June 2000, or maybe it was June in WWDC, but they wanted to sell 10 million units by the end of 2008. And they did hit that. They sold like 15. They sell 15 million iPhones like in the first 5 minutes after they go on sale in September now, maybe more. The first generation just has to work like that. And I think we're seeing that with Vision Pro. We have to be patient, but there's so much more potential for this device than anything else Apple has ever made. And I could also envision a future where the Mac doesn't really disappear, but the Mac becomes an advanced thing within the Vision OS world, where your Mac is no longer a device.
That's what I see. Yeah.
It's a mode within Vision Pro that most users won't need, but if you're a developer, that's what you do. And so it's weird to me that you still can't make iPad apps on an iPad. I think that's sort of a condemnation of the Apple allowing the iPad to thrive and be what it could be. It is a very strange computer that can't make software for itself. I could see in the future where Vision does that. You can write full-fledged Vision software in Vision OS, but you're using a Mac within Vision OS to do it. A
virtualization of, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Where you That's get awesome. The command line and right. all the Xcode and all this stuff that you can't do.
Well, you'll have a bunch of AI assistants sitting around you that are just suggesting right. ideas to you. And then I'll go write this code for you. And then it comes right. back and solves it for you.
Right.
Yeah.
The first time I used the Meta Quest, whatever version it was, I was like, can I just like the thing that was most appealing to me was the I want to be in this virtual world. Can I go read a book in this virtual world? So like, that's almost what I want is like, could I code this in this virtual? This will be amazing. Yeah. Right. Okay. I want to transition real quick before we have to go. I want to, John wanted to talk about this, but also since Chris hasn't been on the show for 6 months, largely, as people have heard, the hashtag has been adopted in quotes by Threads and Meta.
It has not been adopted. It has been vascularized.
All right. So Chris, go first if you want to say what you want to say, and then John, please go ahead and jump in and. But Chris, since you haven't had the platform yet.
Well, let me go. Let me go first and just say that I don't remember when exactly you did, but I again, in a way, this is one way that you and I are. I think linked forever.
Yes.
Linked forever is there's. I can't tell you how frequently now people come up to, or not come up to me on the street, but come up to me virtually and say, "I can't believe you're the person who invented Markdown." And I'm like, "Yeah, I invented Markdown and wrote the wrote the spec, wrote the first parser. That's my baby." And they're like, "I had no idea." And same way, Chris invented the hashtag. I guess like it was. I'm gonna guess it was like 2009, 2007. Or was that early? Yeah. But people don't know that. And I think that, you know, certainly my son is 20. I think people of his generation probably just can't imagine a world without them and social media, you know, and that it was invented. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know if everybody listening to the show knows this, but Chris just literally came up with the idea that you could just preface a tag and put a hashtag in front of it, put the pound sign in front of it, creating a thing that you could search, because that was the only, that was the whole idea. Yeah. And then you'd have this string of characters you could search for, and then all the tweets that had the same string would show up in the search. There was no integration from Twitter itself, so they weren't hot links. You weren't, you couldn't click on them. They were just
Stupid looking words.
Yeah. Right, just stupid looking words. And but then, you know, and the same way somebody else, I forget, I think it was not quite invented, but similar to at username was a way of referencing somebody. And again, and
retweets.
Right.
Yeah, also they, retweets.
None of the, you'd type the letters RT,
RT colon, space username, and then,
all of that stuff was invented by users and then became adopted by the platform. And they were like, oh, well, let's do it properly and actually make it a thing people can click.
Well, no, actually, I mean, again, and the funny thing is like, you know, Twitter resisted it in the beginning. Wow. They hated it. They didn't want it. And the only way that it came to Twitter was as a Trojan horse through acquisitions, because third parties like Semeyes, which then became the Twitter search engine, had adopted it for their product.
How do you know that they resisted it? Who was the people resisting? I mean, what should they name names? It's old enough now. It's old enough now.
No, I mean, especially Biz. There was actually a little mini fake trailer for like a Twitter movie or something years ago. And there's this like moment where like the actor playing Biz Stone comes around the corner and he's like, hashtags. And he's like so angry. I mean, that was literally like the vibe that I got from people at Twitter. And I had plenty of people on the inside that would tell me this, you know? And so, look, it worked out. It's fine. I just like, I guess I will always have a little chip on my shoulder, because it's sort of like one of those things where it's like, look, I'm open to better ideas. I'm open to better solutions. You know, I'm open to, you know, evolutions, but in terms of the problems that we needed to solve at the time, it was the best possible kind of worst solution of all of them.
Well, think about like a cruise ship, right? There's 5,000 passengers and there's, I don't know, a couple hundred crew members, and the crew decides where the ship is going and what you're going to eat and what's going to happen and all this stuff. Mm. But and platforms like Twitter, it's especially social ones, tend to think of themselves as being the, you know, we're the crew, we steer the ship. But social,
I'm the captain now.
Social platforms are different than a cruise ship, right? We didn't need a mutiny to do it.
But the user
behavior en masse steers the platform, and there was nothing. Twitter not adopting it and sort of wanting to ignore it and wishing it would go away didn't change the fact that more and more people were getting, oh, I get what these things are. I'm going to use them too. I'm going to put them in my tweets. I'm going to search for them. We're going to form communities where our community will use this hashtag so that whether you're following the people or not, you get these de facto groups. That the user behavior in large steered the platform. And the resistance was them like, hey, this is our platform. We're the ones who are supposed to be steering this.
That was constantly the case with Twitter also. I mean, old school Twitter.
Yes. Right? I think Twitter in particular had an obstinate culture.
Absolutely.
Chris, give you the platform now to express why you don't like how Threads has, you would say not adopted. Yes, go ahead.
So I think it's, let's see. you know, I've written a couple posts like about these things. I don't write as much as I used to. And so, you know, I wrote about Blue Sky because Blue Sky wanted to get rid of hashtags and move on to something else. Mastodon sort of has changed their adoption and implementation of hashtags to some degree. In many cases, there are very valid complaints about hashtag abuse. And look, you know, you invent the gun, you invent the murder. Like that isn't what the gun was invented for, but yes, that's like, well, maybe it was, but in my case, that's not what the hashtag was for. It was to bring preferably offline communities together using social media, you know, whether that was going to South by Southwest or whether it was for the Barcamp community. The idea was to make the social web reflect more of what was happening in the real world. And so to bring those things together. And so the reason why I have fought for consistency in the design and execution of the hashtag is to build a broader social web, a social fabric that connects all platforms that connect people together. And then you can build filtering and you can build reputation systems. You can, you know, prevent spam, or you can do whatever you want in those cases. Look, I worked on Google Plus, and that was the first time where I had to fight for the hashtag because, you know, like many engineering cultures, they're like, look, I know how to do this better. You guys are, you know, the people who came before are a bunch of idiots. You know, we'll figure this out. The whole NIH thing. And so Google Plus, they wanted to have spaces in their hashtags where you'd have a pound symbol and then you'd have this space is space my space hashtag pound symbol. Great. Okay, fine. Like that's not very different than what Threads did. The problem is that when you send that content, you know, and as someone who's been in the blogosphere and, you know, thought about RSS and, you know, came up with the predecessor to ActivityPub, the idea is that when you syndicate this content, you need to have some things that are consistent. You need to have a JPEG format. You need to have a GIF or GIF format, even if you don't say it the same way. You need to have a ping format. All of these things allow different clients on the broader social web to render these things consistently. And so when you break the convention of the hashtag, you break consistency and you break community conversations across the web. And so when Threads came out with their approach to hashtags, they allow you to lop off the pound symbol prefix. They allow you to add spaces, and they have not made it clear what happens when those tags get federated to the social web, the Fediverse, nor do they make it clear that the prefix will be added back so that people actually know what is a tag and what is just a normal word. So for example, I've exported my data from Threads, and where I have Franken tags, as they call them on Threads, there is no identifier that says this is a tag. Whereas if I mention at John Gruber, then I can find all the mentions of at John Gruber, and that relates to a specific person. It doesn't get rewritten as John Gruber, you know, or John Smith. It is specifically a username on a platform. And so the loss of cardinality and specificity is something that I think is a great loss, or at least at risk of being a great loss on the social web. And so that's my critique so far, in a nutshell, of the Threads implementation of Franken tags.
And here I am in the very unfamiliar to me place of the the proponent and defender of Meta. Which,
oh boy.
But I am a big fan of Threads, and Threads has really opened my mind to reevaluating my opinion of the whole entire company. My take on this, and I like the way that they've, and I honestly innovated in this area where they're not hashtags. That's the main thing. They're just tags. And so in other words, instead of hashtags is a way of tagging where you use the hash mark on your keyboard.
Yes, they have a hash.
And then
if they don't have a hash.
Then and a string just of characters with no spaces because it's not just convention. It's part of the whole thing. And yes. Theirs is more like hypertext where like in a, you know, just the way that you wrap, if you know HTML, an A tag around text, and it can be around anything, right. Multiple words. And I'm happy to see them trying that because to me, the original idea for hashtag, the brilliance of it is that the idea worked within Twitter as it was. It wasn't Chris saying, wasn't a manifesto from Chris saying, if Twitter did X, Y, and Z, we'd have this great new feature. No, it was just, hey, if we, the users, would do this in our tweets right now, we'll have this.
If enough people do this, it'll work.
It sounds like Web 2.0.
And I've used this analogy. And again, I do think one of the things that, and why I love, why I jumped on the chance to come on the show and talk with Chris about it, is I feel like too many of us, everything is so, everybody wants to be angry all the time. And so we've lost the ability to have a good spirited disagreement, right?
It's sure. Like, it's not even that. It's like, you know, like you could be a Red Sox fan and, you know, like be upset with their pitching, you know? Right. So look, I will say positive things about threads and their Franken tags. I like the way that they look.
Well,
I can have a tag with spaces in it. I think I think it's disingenuous not to identify some of the compromises that come from that design. So for example, how do trending topics work in that system? Have you tried looking for search results for these tags? It just lumps everything together, whether there's a tag or whether there's not a tag. And so you get a very, it's not like Twitter. Like I used to be able to go to Twitter and search for a hashtag and see just the results that had the tags. That is not possible in threads. And so we lose the ability to have coherence in these emergent spaces, which is what hashtags provided. And so I agree with you. Like I'm happy to see attempts at positive innovation. It's just that the way that they implemented it, because when you use the pound symbol to bring up the interface for creating a tag, the default is to remove the hash in front, which as far as I'm concerned, from a default's perspective, is neutralizing the likelihood that any hashtags will exist. They also added the restriction of having one tag per post. And that seems insufficient to cover, you know, the needs of many posts. Like I'm happy with maybe 3. 1,000 is not a, you know.
I'm not sure, and I think they could add to that limit.
Of course.
Let me say this. Here's
maybe the most for sure.
Before we run out of time, I just want to use my analogy, which I've used debating with Chris online, which is to file name extensions, where if you have here's my file .txt, it's this. The .txt is metadata. It is a way of saying this file is a plain text file, but it's not in a field devoted to what type is this file. It's stashed into a field that is just for the name. And hashtags are very much like file name extensions in that way, in that they are metadata that is not in a dedicated metadata field. They're just...
It reveals the intention. Or what the data is.
And there's also, I think the analogy works a lot, is the other thing. And so the classic Macintosh, classic, literally the old one, didn't have file name extensions, didn't use them. And it actually had a separate metadata field for the type of files. And it was far more graceful and elegant and also made cross-platform compatibility. And you couldn't
do Windows to Mac sharing.
Right. Exactly. And you could use spaces in your file names. And so readme files on the classic Mac were spelled capital R, read space me with no dot, no text. Right. And they opened in the text editor. And then if you copied that file to a DOS floppy disk and put it in a PC, it was like, I can't even read the floppy disk.
It's such a good example. Like, and so, I just want to like, yeah, go ahead.
So again, with this federation angle, with threads, and it is weird. So it's like on the one hand, threads is threads was doing what we would have thought a year ago Meta would do, which is build its own silo with no connection to the outside world other than their own like Instagram Meta product, then their own this is our way of doing tagging on posts would be fine. 100%. The part where I'm as a proponent of Thread's way of doing tagging, the way that I most see the problem is, but yet you're saying you want to federate, and by all appearances, they're working on it. You can there's a handful of users like Adam Mosseri who you can actually follow from Mastodon.
On Mastodon,
And so at that point, it's sort of like, you know, this is why Mac OS X went with file name extensions. Like Mac OS actually reverted in terms of gracefulness from a platform that had a much more elegant metadata system for type to a system that was crude but worked everywhere. And
much more universal. You
know, that's where the problem hits with thread style of tagging. The limit of one, I can't help but feel, is fueled by their experience with Instagram, where
100%
thirsty Instagrammers are, you know, there's Everybody,
I will just add to this point, like the difference is that when you add a comment on Instagram, you are not restricted to characters. Whereas on Threads, you've got what, 500 characters? And so the same type of hashtag abuse that you experience on Instagram is far less likely. And so that's also where I'm kind of like, well, which is it? Which do you want to be? Are you preventing the type of bad stuff that happens on Instagram? Or like, are you trying to maybe the greatest irony of this is that when you actually see things like Frankentag, like tech threads, I can't even say the word, it looks awkward at the end of a post. Because when people are attempting to tag their posts, it just looks like sort of a strange word in the middle of a, you know, sentence or something now, or at the end of it. So anyways, I recommend to listeners is you can still create conventional hashtags, just hit a double pound on the keyboard, and then type your thing, and then you too can demand hashtags just like I do.
But I can't let that slide without pointing out the way that hashtags in and of themselves are kind of ugly.
Oh, I'm not going to disagree with that at all.
Right.
Yeah. So you can have that one. That's fine. But the greater benefit and the greater good, look, I mean, interoperability with the Windows platform was probably necessary for the Mac's ascent. Right. So you know what I mean? You got to like take what you can get.
Whenever I need to do financial research for this show, for instance, during tech earnings season, when I have to analyze how various companies' stocks have been performing, I only ever turn to our sponsor today, Yahoo Finance. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They are the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. With a community of over 90 million users each month, their real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Right. I almost did a show with the 99% invisible guy about it's the numero sign. Like, everything's ugly. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Well, you know what? Let me just add this. One of the other little benefits of Chris's invention of hashtags is, it's actually helped clarify what people call that symbol. I think that you would find
that's true. Between the number sign, the pound sign.
I'm on Wikipedia right now.
Literally call it the hashtag.
What else is there? The bang? Or no, the bang is the exclamation mark.
That's the exclamation.
But there's other names for it.
Yeah,
the numeral sign, the pound sign.
Right?
Do we say that?
Yes.
Numeral, pound. Everybody now calls it the hash.
When I look at Wikipedia, Chris, the photo they have for you.
No. Yeah. No. Can you edit that, please? I can't edit my own Wikipedia pages.
Anyway. Okay. What we need to do is close this down. John.
Me go long on a podcast. Oh, my God.
Shocking. Shocking.
John, Chris, thank you for coming on to do this. Chris, unless you want to, promote anything, John, we know you have, Daring Fireball and your various podcasts, but please, I will give you the floor to, talk about whatever you want.
I'll throw out a shout out to my Dithering podcast that I do with my friend Ben Thompson at dithering.fm, which is, 2 episodes a week, 15 minutes every episode, not a second less $5 a month, no ads, 2 episodes a week, 15 minutes. So if you like short podcasts, unlike this one or my other podcast, Dithering is the one for you. So I would
by the way, I got to ask you, like, just in terms of the Spotify paywall, because that's using OAuth, like, how is that going and is it working?
I think it's, long story short, that's Ben's problem, not mine. And, but I believe that it is working very well. And I, okay. You know, and I was resistant to Spotify's attempt to sort of take
over. I feel like it's another great example where, you know, these big platforms have moved towards the open web. And so, you know, I just wanted to get a sense for.
Well, and going where the users are, right? And yeah, I've never gone wrong in my career building Daring Fireball by listening to what people want. I mean, there's the whole thing where I started selling RSS sponsorships because I was doing password protected RSS feeds for members in like 2005. And then Google Reader came along and didn't support passwords, but people wanted to use Google Reader. And I thought, well, I'll just give the full feed to everybody and I'll put sponsorships in there. And now it's like half my income.
That's amazing. Awesome.
Listen to the users.
This is great. Yeah.
Yes. Amen. So, you know, whatever. Daring Fireball. By the way, John, I'm going to give you this. You and this will be a little not great, but Adam Carolla were the two podcasts that got me into podcasting. You and Dan Benjamin back in the day. And so I've made my living for 6 years now as a podcaster. So I appreciate you tremendously.
Well, that is a thrill to hear. Honestly, no sarcasm intended. I mean it.
I can remember going to a Jersey Mike's and listening to you on an actual iPod and being like, that's where I could do that.
I love Jersey Mike's, by the way.
Yeah, me too. All right. Chris, be well. John, be well. Yes, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show, everybody.